You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Back from London and Portland for the Christmas holidays. And this week, of course, is the New Year's holiday, but we're live here on the air today and having a fine time at it. There's a lot. Now, did you see the story about the NSA? They actually, you order a computer from a company, and the NSA intercepts the delivery, opens the computer up, installs spyware on it, and then puts it back, you know, into the delivery stream, and both the manufacturer and you never even knew that they did it. This is called the Taylor Access Operation. Der Spiegel is reporting on it. It's getting bizarre. It's getting downright bizarre. Meanwhile, it is of course the week after Christmas, and so what else would Republicans do than cut off unemployment benefits to 1.4 million people?
You don't need no unemployment benefit. May I, sir, may I please have a lump of coal? No, you may not.
Playing the role of Scrooge on our program today, Neil McCabe, conservative commentator, editor of Guns and Patriots newsletter, neilwmccabe.com, his website. Hey, Neil, welcome back.
Hey, great to be with you, and thank you for a classic Tom Hartman introduction.
I thought you would appreciate that.
Absolutely, man. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Neil, this seems to me, to be bad politics to say to millions of people, sorry, we're not going to extend your unemployment benefits during a time of recession. I understand in 1980 when Reagan and Carter were running against each other and unemployment was 3.6%, and we actually calculated it differently, so it actually probably was around 3.6%. But now, I mean, you've got unemployment somewhere between 7 and 20%, depending on how you calculate it. And number two, so it seems like bad politics. It seems like bad policy. Because the job creators in our economy, of course, are the low-wage workers. They're the people who spend 100% of the money they get. And if they're not working, if they're getting benefits like unemployment benefits, all of that money is going immediately into the economy, into stimulating the economy. And it seems like bad morality. I don't get it. How can you, as a Republican, or either speaking on your own behalf or on behalf of the party, I realize you don't speak on behalf of the party, but, you know, how can you justify this?
Well, I just want to back up and make sure that we're talking about the same thing. Is this the cutoff of extended unemployment benefits? Was that part of the compromise between Paul Ryan and Patty Murray?
No. The unemployment benefits back in 2008, when the crash happened, they decided to extend unemployment benefits for 99 weeks after the 26 weeks that you normally get. In the big, almost shut down the government deal, President Obama gave the Republicans, they dialed that from 99 weeks back to either 74 or 76 weeks as a sweetener to get the Republicans to go along with the deal in extended unemployment benefits. And this failure to extend that extension takes it to just the straight 26 weeks.
So we're basically back to where we were before, which is
in 2007.
6 months is very generous, don't you?
No, I frankly, I think everybody in the country should have a minimum income. I agree with Thomas Paine, but that's a whole different discussion.
Because when we take, just like every other sort of government safety net program, when you tax money or take money from one group of people and give it to another group of people, it's pretty much a zero sum game, except for the huge cut that the government bureaucrats take for managing the social program.
Oh, they're getting richer than we can imagine, Neil. It's just mind boggling. I mean, Stephen J. Hemsley has what, 8 houses? I mean, these government bureaucrats must have 10, 12.
Well, I mean, you know how they live. How much work they really do pushing papers around. There's tens of thousands around them just around your studio. And, the commute back to the wealthy suburbs of Maryland is full of these government hacks. Please.
So
please try to find one on a Friday afternoon, Tom.
So you know you're suggesting, Neil, that because unemployment benefits are paid for by people who work for the government, in other words, they determine who gets them, they make sure that the checks get out on time, that we should do away with the program? Are you seriously saying that?
No, what I'm saying, Tom, is that nobody has a problem with short-term assistance to people who are in need.
26 weeks.
Six months is very generous, and it's enough. And if it's not enough, then, you know, then people need to go into the free economy. And so we need to preserve a free economy that's there for them. The other point
But Neil, capitalism has failed.
Is that the government.
We got robbed by the banksters.
The expense of running these programs with these huge growing.
No, we pay into unemployment benefit. When you're working, part of the taxes that are taken out of your pay cover unemployment benefits. We're paying for this. We all.
You're paying for the 99.
You know, if I ever go on unemployment benefits, I will have been paying into that most of my life. It's an insurance program, just like any other insurance program, Neil. It's not a pension or a welfare program. It's an insurance program. We all pay into it collectively to cover the risk of a relatively small number of us who need it.
Well, then where obviously there's. There's a savings to the federal government that is important because right now we're running at a deficit. And so 26 weeks, to pay out over 26 weeks, the government has to borrow money to cover that.
Maybe right? Not. I mean, you know, the government borrows money. The government also has an incredible. Well, they also have a lot of income. I mean, you know, trillions of dollars come into the government tax dollars every year. You don't know which are allocated to which. I could make the case that 100% of the defense budget is borrowed and everything else is paid for out of tax revenues.
All right, I'll almost accept that. The other thing I want to talk to you about is, one, there are studies that show that people are reluctant or hesitant to search for new jobs until they're at the end of their benefits. In Denmark, that's a huge problem where benefits run, I think, 5 years, and people start looking for work in their fourth year. But here in this country, I know people in my own family who have been on extended unemployment benefits, and then as it started to run out, they decided to, you know, rejoin the workforce.
Well, it must be something that has to do with the McCabe genes, Neil, because I've been on this planet longer than you, and I have never known anybody who would rather not have a job.
There are people listening to us right now who are on unemployment benefits and are sort of looking at the calendar saying, well, things are running out. The other thing, though, is if there's...
But the jobs aren't there, Neil.
To be on a positive side, Tom, there are proposals to sort of offer people lump sums so that when you're unemployed, rather than saying it's 26 weeks or whatever it is, let's say it's at 26 weeks, say a lump sum. We say, you know, rather than pay you for 26 weeks, we'll give you a lump sum right now.
Oh, there's a million proposals out there. We could go back to Thomas Paine's proposal in Agrarian Justice that every person at birth be endowed with a trust fund so that when they turn 21, they'll have a guaranteed income for the rest of their life. I mean, there's lots and lots of proposals. The reality is, though, that today, over the last 2 days, 1.3 million Americans have lost their lifeline, have lost their ability to pay their mortgages.
Well, I mean, and they.
What do you say to them?
They have a house that they're paying a mortgage on. There's a lot of people without houses. I mean, you're talking about, you know, there's a lot of middle class people who are going to have to make adjustments, but there's also a lot of working class people who don't have houses and who don't have these.
So just lose your house.
Life. What's that?
Just lose your house. Suck it up.
Well, what do you mean, Tom? I mean, they didn't see this coming?
I think a lot of people who are unemployed didn't think that the banks were going to screw us. They didn't think that Phil Graham was going to set this thing up.
We should have never bailed out the banks, Tom. I think we both agree on that.
But that doesn't help the guy who's unemployed because of policy decisions that you and I might agree on. Anyhow, Neil McCabe, we're out of time. NeilWMcCabe.com. Thanks, Neil.
All right, be good.
Yep. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, Neil, I wish you the very best for the new year. Good talking with you, if you're still there. We'll be back. Well, the other kind of traditional thing that programs do at the end of the year is look back at the year. I'm not so into that. I think, you know, at a certain level, that's kind of lazy journalism, I suppose, or obligatory. Oh, let's do the year in review. We were all there. All right. We know what happened. The Republicans passed a bunch of laws to make it harder for people to vote. And an amazing study that was done that found that 93% of Americans think that ice cream is a good thing. 90% think that our gun control laws should be tightened up. And yet Congress did nothing about it. Congress has a approval rating just slightly below that of cockroaches. Now, who likes cockroaches? I don't. Apparently, somebody does. I don't know. It's amazing. But this unemployment thing, what this says to me is that if the Republicans can get away with this, and they already did to a large extent. I mean, like I said, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, remember the 99ers? I mean, the 99-week unemployment benefits got cut back to 74 weeks, I think it was, as part of a deal between the administration and the Republicans in order to get stop the government from being shut down and get the debt ceiling lifted. It was one of those phony crises that the Republicans love to create. And, you know, they screwed a bunch of unemployed people then, and they didn't pay for it at the polls. They're doing it now, and we'll see, but I have a feeling they won't pay for it at the polls. Because there's this fundamental economic ignorance that Americans have, which we didn't used to have. I mean, literally, you go back when I was writing The Crash of 2016, my new book, there is a chapter in there that opens with an article from Time Magazine. And as I recall, it was Time Magazine. And as I recall, it was 1966. I'd have to dig the book out and get it. But it was around the time of the Jetsons and all this stuff, you know, and they were pointing out that, you know, productivity and wages have been following each other for centuries in the United States, in North America. And if wages continue to follow productivity, then we're going to have a very simple formula here. The average middle-class American, by the year 2000, now this is back in 66, by the year 2000, is going to be no longer the middle class, but the upper middle class. They're going to be making anywhere from $75,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year to $200,000 a year. People who back in 1966 were making, you know, in today's dollars, the equivalent of, you know, $15,000 or $20,000 on the low end to around $40,000, $45,000 on the high end, the average individual income to the average household income. And it was just assumed that these two things would follow each other. Because in 66, Reaganomics hadn't been even invented, much less put into place. But the fact that the Republicans can get away with this belies this fundamental economic ignorance. Americans somehow think, the fact that Mitt Romney almost got, you know, half the vote, Americans somehow think that rich people create jobs. Rich people don't create jobs. Rich people actually take away jobs. What creates jobs is working people, poor people, middle class people. People spending money is what creates jobs. Now, you can argue that, you know, Bill Gates adding another wing to his house creates some jobs. And yeah, okay, you know, he's got to hire some guys to do it. Or Larry Ellison buying a new yacht, you know, creates some jobs. Although I think most of the yacht building business is not in the United States. I think it's in, you know, Greece or France or something. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that after people's basic needs are met, and for rich people that might be a little higher than the average person, but after people's basic needs are met, the additional money that they make doesn't go to build a factory. And you say, well, they're investing it. They're putting money in the stock market. Well, putting money in the stock market doesn't do a thing. When this is, another one of those things that people don't understand about how the economy works. If I buy 1,000 shares of Apple, Apple doesn't see a penny of that money. I'm buying that 1,000 shares from somebody else who just sold 1,000 shares. The only time that Apple makes a penny off my buying Apple stock, which I by the way, I own no Apple stock, so I use it as an example. The only time that Apple would make money is what's called an IPO, an initial public offering. In other words, when Apple first goes to the marketplace, like Twitter just did, like Facebook did earlier this year, when they first go to the marketplace and they say, okay, we've got a bunch of stock and we will sell that stock. And they sell the stock and they take the money. And that's how they capitalize the company. But once that's done, all that stock does is move from hand to hand to hand. So, you know, as the stock market goes up, these companies aren't making a penny more. Now, they can increase their profits by buying back their own stocks and then declaring dividends. And every share of stock you hold, you get a dividend on it. And so the companies are taking their own dividends, or they're giving their stock to their employees. I mean, there's all these fancy ways to do it, but people don't understand this. They think somehow rich people are creating jobs by putting their money in the stock market. Putting their money in the stock market doesn't create a job for anybody except maybe a stockbroker. And it probably isn't even creating a job for a stockbroker. It's just adding to the amount of money in his Swiss bank account. The true job creators in an economy are literally the people on welfare, the people on unemployment, and the people who work for a living.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How is it that we have become so economically stupid in this country, or ignorant is probably the better word, that Republicans can get away with this? Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. The French millionaire tax, by the way, has cleared. Our third hour is going to be all about that. In our second hour, this is now becoming a serious movement is the wrong word, but you know, it's kind of coming out of the shadow. Polygamy. Should polygamy be decriminalized? I say no. I'm not in favor of the state recognizing polygamy. But that's, you know, I have no problem people having plural relationships and whatnot. But that's a whole different thing. We'll get into that and how and why. It's more of a social issue, but I think it's a fascinating one. But and you know, it's the end of the year. I mean, if the well, it's not anything goes Friday, and in fact, that will be this Friday. Bernie will be with us this Friday, by the way. We'll be doing live shows on Thursday and Friday this week. And tomorrow we're going to be live, aren't we? No. Oh, tomorrow's the best of show. Okay. So tomorrow and Wednesday we have off. But we have really good shows put together for you where Shane has spent hours going through some of our very best rants of the year. I got to tell you, you're giving me that look. Like, say what? You keep them all year. Yeah, I know. You go, you know, as we every now and then I'll just like hit my stride and Shane goes, oh, that's a good one, and he sets it aside. Yeah. It's nice having a producer who is as good at or better than I am at my own job, at doing my job. Him doing his job. I think I do my job fairly well, and I, you know, Jim, Danielle, Shane, we've got a great team here, some great people. Anyhow, Steve in Rochester, New York. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching the show. You wanted to disagree with me, and so Danielle moved you to the top of the list because that's the magic word.
Well, I don't know if I want to disagree with you. I think so. But the thing about the unemployment intrigues me because upstate New York, we had a huge apple crop this past year. And a lot of it could not be picked.
Right.
We didn't have the manpower.
You ever picked apples, Steve?
Now, never. I realized the immigration thing, but I had relatives here who were on unemployment, and I said to them, look it, you can go out and make a buck. No, they said, I'd lose part of my unemployment.
You didn't go out
to get a job.
Well, you would. First of all, have you ever picked apples?
Yeah.
Yeah, so have I.
I've done a lot of...
Yeah, I picked apples for I think it was 50 cents a lug we were getting back in the day. It was, you know, I was 16 or 17, and it was a summer job. And up in White Cloud, Michigan, in northern Michigan. And it's hard work, but I'm not objecting to hard work. And it's badly paid hard work, and I'm not objecting to badly paid hard work. But the fact of the matter is that if you're drawing unemployment compensation and you take a few weeks and you start making some income, if you don't report the income, you've committed a crime. If you do commit the income, you can totally screw up your ability to continue getting unemployment benefits, and you end up having to go jump through all these bureaucratic hoops. I totally understand why they would say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, so do I. But the thing is, why don't we change the law?
Well, you could. I mean, you know, you could change the law. But the main reason that we don't change the law is because Republicans think that these laws should be punitive.
Wait a minute.
You know.
Whoa. Let's back that up a second. Tom. You keep blaming the Republicans for all these
things. Well, there's a few Democrats who are like that, too.
Well, yeah. No. You see, both of them do it. For instance, the antitrust thing that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Obama's been in for a while. We had Clinton before him. If this antitrust thing was getting so far out of whack, why didn't they do something about it?
Well, that's a damn good question, Steve, and I totally agree with you on that. And I think I've made the point probably a few thousand times on this program that since 1981, we have been in a Reaganomics era. And even though we've had two reasonably good Democratic presidents, you know, given the constraints that they've had of the Congresses that they've had to deal with and everything else, and in particular the constraints that they've had to deal with regard to things like the Buckley decision, the First National Bank decision, the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court, but we're still... We have not gone back to the Great Society era. We have not gone back to the FDR era. We are in Reaganomics. We have been for is it 23 years or 32 years? I'm starting. It's the end of the year. You can really. I was on a flight from London yesterday, and the day before that, or 2 days before that, I flew from Portland to London, and then the day 3 days before that, I flew. I'm so jet lagged. I don't know which way is up, but net, we're still in this Reaganomics era, and I think, you know, we need a fundamental change. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. We need to change our trade policies. I mean, there's so much, and we need to start enforcing the Sherman Act, the Antitrust Act. There's so many things that we need to be doing that are just simple, straightforward things that'll bring back the middle class that we're not doing, and that Democrats don't do either. And they're not doing, in part because, you know, they don't have a majority. In part, I mean, I just saw this story here on Democratic Underground. This is from Gawker, actually. Sunday talk show guests, 2013. And they're looking at who was on the Sunday shows the most often. The most with 27 appearances was Rogers. So he's a Republican. And then McCain, a Republican. Then Gingrich, a Republican. Then Durbin, a Democrat with like 18 visits. And then Peter King, a Republican, then Graham, a Republican, then Rand Paul, a Republican, then Schumer, a Democrat, then McCall, a Republican, then Corker, a Republican, then Cruz, a Republican, then Joe Manchin, who calls himself a Democrat, but I'm not sure what he is, and then Kelly Ayotte, who's a Republican. In other words, there's only three Democrats out of the top, what is this, 15 or something like this? You know, I mean, it's like America is just being spoon-fed right-wing pablum on a continuous basis, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're so economically ignorant.
Well, now, Tom, but what you're really saying there, aren't you really saying?
I'm listening.
Yeah. Okay. I'm assuming that you're talking about the big three networks, CBS.
Yes. What I'm saying basically is that the establishment takes care of its own. and that the establishment of the establishment, the inside of the establishment, are the Republicans and some of the Democrats, who are right. You know, the you know, without naming names, I think it's fairly obvious who they are.
Well, I find it amazing that you think that the Republicans have that much control over the networks, but that's, you know, I'll move.
I don't think it's that the Republicans have control over the network, Steve. I think it's that if you're a network executive and you're making decisions about guests you're going to put on the air, and you're making $5 or $10 million a year as your salary, are you going to put a guest on the air like Bernie Sanders who says, you know, we should be taxing that at 74%. We should be rolling back the Reagan tax cuts, which Bernie has openly called for on this program. Or are you going to put on the air somebody who says, you know, we should do a flat tax and make sure everybody only pays 17%?
Well, you know,
I'm still listening.
I think it's amazing that you'd think that some of those top flight reporters that take so much pride in being responsible reporters.
But they don't anymore, Steve. They don't. It's infotainment. I mean, look at David Gregory. The best he can do is a gotcha question. These guys, you know, these salaries for these guys start in the millions. These people are millionaires.
Yeah, I realize that.
They're stars. They're TV stars. They're not reporters anymore. They're stars.
Yeah, I don't want to monopolize the problem.
I mean, if you want a reporter, look at Amy Goodman on Democracy Now. She's, in my opinion, she's the last reporter. I'm not a reporter. I'm a commentator. I'll be the first to tell you that. But Amy Goodman is, I think, you know, one of the last reporters left. You know, Glenn Greenwald, apparently, there's a new agency coming along, a new group coming along. But, Steve, thank you for the call. I've got a whole board full of calls here. Let's try and pick up some more. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I found it kind of interesting that you thought that the NSA sticking some spyware into computers was a strange concept. Back in the 90s, the U.S. government was talking about forcing all computer manufacturers to include firmware in the computer, chips that is, that would allow a permanent backdoor that the government could access the computer anytime it wished.
But they didn't. But to the best of my knowledge, they didn't get away with it. I mean, that was a scandal. I remember when that happened, and there was, you know, pushback from the computer manufacturers. In this case, they're going around the manufacturers. The manufacturers apparently don't even realize it. It's got to be a deal that they've got with the delivery companies or something.
Are you certain? I mean, are you certain that they haven't got around to giving out some of those national security letters to the manufacturers and actually putting the chips in the computers?
Well, this is Der Spiegel is reporting, and here's the story. Steve Kaufman writing over at Raw Story says, Der Spiegel reported on Sunday that the NSA's tailored access operations has been diverting desktops and laptops shipped to U.S. consumers and installing spyware on them. Manufacturers like Dell, Cisco, and Seagate installing bugs or spyware on them at a secret workshop. The package is then reintroduced into the delivery pipeline. Now, I bought an Apple computer, a year and a half ago or so, and I literally watched it by FedEx being delivered from Shanghai, you know, all the way to here. So, you know, maybe it's all happening outside the country. I don't know.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's very strange, though, and Cisco says that they're deeply concerned about this. Again, you know, I think it's a good thing that this stuff is coming out. Welcome back. Carolyn in Middletonia, Virginia. Am I saying that right, Carolyn?
Midlothian.
Midlothian. Thank you.
Yes.
Watching on Free Speech TV. Thanks for the call. What's up?
I take issue with the comment about people trading stocks, not creating jobs, because there are a ton of people who sell their stock and then take it and invest it in their small business. They hire new employees, and they invest in.
But they had to buy the stock in the first place, which means that they earned an income somewhere. Or are you saying that because the value of the stock market is going up?
That's right. Hello.
Right.
The value of the stock market is going up.
Right.
And that's why they're selling, because they're getting an income.
Right.
Based on their investment.
Right.
And they're taking that money and they're investing it in their company.
I disagree.
and well, you can disagree all you want, but hey, you talked about the people who are ignorant and idiotic about the economy. Guess what? This is Econ 101. You ought to
know. So you're suggesting, Carolyn, let me get this straight, because my understanding of business, and I've started seven of them, has always been that you start a business because you see a demand in the marketplace and you want to meet that demand. But you're suggesting that people start businesses because they happen to have a capital gain from selling stocks.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Can you give me an example?
I've sold stock, and I've taken it, and I've invested it in my small business, and I've hired additional people because of that. So you're going to tell me that I did not increase?
I am telling you, Carolyn, that, and I realize how presumptuous this is, and my apologies in advance, but I am telling you that you did not hire those people and expand that business simply because you sold those stocks. You did so because there was a demand for the product or service you were selling. If there was no demand for it.
If there was demand for the product, the only way I could service that demand was to be able to provide the product.
Right.
And I couldn't provide the product without the employees. And without the capital.
Right, but
so
you don't need to sell stock to get that capital. You can borrow that capital from a bank. You can use your credit card. You can.
Oh, sure.
I mean, there's a lot of ways to raise money.
Don't tell me that you cannot improve the economy and hire people and improve the economy because of that. And I'll tell you something about unemployment. 2 years ago, I was out of work for 1 month in May. So the whole month of May, I collected unemployment, which I've paid into for 37 years now. Paid got that unemployment check for a month. In November of that year, the company that I went with in June and through November went belly up. And I applied for unemployment. I was not allowed to have it because I had already had it that year.
Yeah.
So I don't know where these people are getting this 99 weeks or however many weeks they're getting. It's amazing to me that people are getting this kind of.
Well, it sounds to me like your employer challenged your claim.
Oh,
is that what happened?
My employer did, because my employer went belly up. They went out of business.
Yeah.
There's no way they could have challenged it.
Interesting. Well, I can't speak to the details and the unique specifics of that. I know that there are a whole bunch of things that disqualify people from getting unemployment. Carolyn, thank you for the call. I'm sorry we have different views of the economy, but I respect yours and your right to share it on our program. Nelson Mandela died this last year. Here's one of my favorite quotes. He said, "Overcoming poverty is not a task of charity. It is an act of justice. Like slavery and apartheid, poverty is not natural. It is man-made, and it can be overcome and eradicated by the actions of human beings. While poverty persists, there is no true freedom." Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard.
Oh, hi. I started off, the reason for calling was that that fellow that you had.
Neil McCabe.
Conservative. Yeah, who he doesn't realize that many, many states, I imagine, I don't know how many, but I know the one I'm in, Illinois, because I've been unemployed for 3 years because of my industry is gone. I'm an architect. But I had to apply all the time. If I didn't apply a certain number of times a week, if they can't call me in and I couldn't do it, I had to give all the money back. So
right, you have to prove that you're looking for a job.
Yeah, you're not at the country club. The great strength of these people is that they don't know anything, but they keep repeating the same nonsense. And as you said, I was going to comment the same way you did, that we don't have a press anymore that would, if they can't stop Ted Cruz from lying, you know, when he's on public, on the Sunday morning shows, and if they can't even say, well, you're full of it, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You can't even question them. I mean, that's what's going on, is people get their information from the media. And as far as that woman who was just on about the stocks, I've worked in major corporations. I'm of the opinion now that the only reason for stocks is to enrich the top people, because I used to get bonused. I used to get stock options. And, I got a little bit of the stuff that they didn't consume.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as having to raise money anymore to build a factory, well, we're in China. You know, Chinese are giving us money to move our stuff there. We don't have to, you know, raise it even here. I mean, Intel gets $1 billion a year to move high tech over there.
Well, and individual states will give you, I mean, you know, look at they're offering $1.7 billion to Boeing. I think it's Missouri to move their factory from Washington State to Missouri. I mean, this is craziness.
Well, Illinois. Yeah, Illinois gave the stock, the commodities group wanted to move out. They're going to leave Lake Forest and the North Shore where everybody has multi-million dollar homes. Yeah, they didn't get $100 million or more or so, and we have TIFs in this state. I mean, the giveaway, and the other giveaway was in the Media Matters, not Media Matters, Center for Ethics and Government, was talking about how guys like Sheldon Edelstein are transferring all of their money, like he's $10 billion to his kids and avoided $2.8 billion
via the Cook Islands.
Taxes. Yeah. You know, I don't know if it was Cook Islands, but he's created like 29 different, they have a name for GATs or something.
Trusts, yeah, they're trusts. Yeah,
a certain trust. And if these people are all worried about the giving our money away to poor people who are going to spend it, you know, why don't they go after some of those people that are avoiding their taxes? You know, and if they don't get taxed, they're going to grow exponentially and eventually own everything, which they just about do now because they don't pay taxes.
Yeah.
And the rest of us are busy paying their taxes for them.
I know. I know. We are subsidizing the rich and the large corporations in an astonishing way in this country. Richard, thank you for the call. Don in Chicago, you disagree with me about unemployment. What does that mean?
You were saying that most people want jobs and they will. You basically disagreed that the deadline, the being cut off, isn't what's going to motivate people, and I think it would.
But what do you do about the fact that for every person looking, for every job looking for a person, there are, depending on where you are in the country, between 3 and 7 people looking for that one job. I mean, this is like musical chairs, and only you know 6 out of 7 people get stuck without a chair when the music stops. How do you deal with that if you don't at the very least have unemployment? Now, frankly, I'm a fan of FDR's solution. Forget about unemployment insurance. Have the government create jobs. Be the employer of last resort. Let's start the CCC again. Let's start the WPA again. Let's build some roads and some bridges. Let's create some good government jobs. But there's no way that that's going to get through Congress. So at least, you know, we'll give people a lifeline.
That would be fantastic if that actually happened. But I just, sometimes I think you don't understand what motivates people. Because, I mean, you say the minimum wage should be $15 an hour. And if that happened, like, no one would go to school for anything.
I think the minimum wage should be $11 or $12 an hour. I'm not sure.
I thought I heard you say 15 before, but maybe.
Yeah, no, I acknowledge is that the people, the fast food strikers, are calling for $15 an hour, and I've had them on this program, and they've said, but we'll settle for 12. I would like to see an economy where the minimum wage is an entry-level wage like it used to be, but the problem is that because we are providing low-income people with welfare benefits, a modification of the old war on poverty programs that happened by Clinton and Gingrich. Now you have a brand-new business model that's only existed for about 15 or 20 years, where that's the McDonald's Walmart business model, which is where you and I as taxpayers pick up anywhere from 10 to 50% of the cost of an employee's cost of living, and the remainder is paid for by the employer with low wages. And that's a lousy business model. It's a lousy way to run an economy.
It is. They definitely take advantage of the taxpayer.
Yeah.
Can I suggest one? I've been trying to get on your show for a long time, and I have a simple idea on how I think it would give us a better shot at getting everything we want.
And that is?
I think we need to have a sliding vote system implemented. And I think that will actually give us a shot at getting
a sliding vote system.
Yes, I'm really disappointed that no one ever talks about it on these progressive talk radio talk shows. Because
well, we have 60 seconds to the end of this hour. Tell me what you're talking about.
Basically, you rank who you want to win from first.
Oh, you're talking ranked voting.
Yes, if your first person, if your first place doesn't win, then it just goes to number two.
No, I'm a big fan of that.
I listen to this station all the time, and no one ever talks about it. I really wish people would start talking about it more.
I talk about this constantly. It's the big accomplishment of the Green Party is that they've got ranked voting, or what's called instant runoff voting, IRV, in over 300 communities now across the United States. In fact, I think it might be over 400 now. San Francisco's the largest. And I'm with you. I think that instant runoff voting is, you know, because we would have to amend our Constitution to get proportional representation. The closest thing we can get is instant runoff voting, which they're doing, by the way, in New Zealand and Australia. And it seems to be working quite well. And I think that we should have here. I'm with you on that, Don. I'm totally with you. I'll have to, if you listen regularly and you haven't heard me talk about it, I must not be talking about it often enough. So we'll get into a little more with that. Don, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back. It's coming up at the top of the hour here. Coming up next, Mark Henkel is going to be with us, a national advocate for polygamy, of all things. And, you know, well, we'll see.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Take it back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Mark Henkel is with us. He is a national polygamy advocate, founder of truthbearer.org, which I assume is a, I'm sorry, Mark, I haven't had a chance to get over and look at your website today. It's been one of those just insane days. But I'm assuming that this is a website that is devoted to promoting the polygamy message.
Well, you can reach me at nationalpolygamyadvocate.com, and yes, I am the founder of the truthbearer.org organization.
Oh, I
see.
You
can reach me at nationalpolygamyadvocate.com.
Okay, got it. So, now, speaking anthropologically, I understand in a society as biblical societies were, Bronze Age societies, 2,000-3,000 years ago, In areas where you have limited resources and constant warfare over those resources, and typically it's the men who are engaging in warfare, and so you end up with two or three women for every man simply because the men are being killed in battle or killed from infections that are the consequence of scratches and whatnot incurred in battle. In that context, polygamy makes sense. But when you look at polygamy as practiced in 50-50 societies where there's equal numbers of men and women, you have this tragic situation in Utah, in Arizona, in northern Mexico, for example, among the polygamous Mormon communities, where when young boys reach 13, 14, 15, 16, typically 16 to 18 years old, where they're old enough to compete with the older men for the girls of their age, and old enough that they're not going to draw the ire of Child Protective Services, they get driven into town and just dumped. You know, this lost boy phenomena, because, you know, how can one man have three wives if two other guys don't have any wives at all? Hello?
Are you a person who believes and would conduct yourself according to the religious paradigms of isolated Mormon sects? Would you believe that mainstream America across the country would conduct themselves based on the paradigms of ancient behavior? Of course not. These are irrelevant examples to use when we're talking about allowing unrelated consenting adults making a choice of polygamy across mainstream America based on people making their own consenting adult choices. You cannot use the example of cults, and especially of criminal cults, and say that that represents what normal everyday Americans across the country making a free choice would do. So you cannot use that as...
Okay, well, let's define some terms here then, Mark, and your tone kind of implies that you think that I'm trying to have a fight with you. I'm genuinely not. I'm not opposed at all to polyamory. In fact, I have a friend who's in a polyamorous relationship. There's two men and two women, and they all live in a house together, and they all, at various times, it seems, you know, sleep with each other, and they have this, you know, basically very, very tight relationship, and have for... Geez, 25 years. I mean, they, you know, this goes back to these people split off from a commune once. I get that, but that seems different than my understanding of polygamy. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it. My understanding of polygamy
is
that.
I would like to help you.
Okay, go for it.
I would like to help you. Your response and the way you described that about your favoring polyamory is. I'm sure I would be correct in agreeing that you likely oppose things such as homophobia as a concept or speech, given what I've understood about you. And what you are doing is no different than polygophobia, in that you are using irrelevant anecdotes to compare to normal society, and then saying, "Well, I know a pair of people that choose to want to have same-sex marriage, so I'm really not homophobic." And it's the same thing what you're doing is you're still saying, "Well, I know a polyamorous, but I'm not really polygophobic." What you're really doing is betraying your own belief system by doing that. So let me educate you about unrelated consenting adults across normal mainstream America making a freedom of choice.
Well, the one argument that I brought to this that was an argument, not a fear, and I don't think is a bigotry, was the story of the Lost Boys. I mean, you know, I've got an article.
I would
from...
be happy to address that.
Okay.
The story of the Lost Boys has nothing to do with polygamy. It has to do with a limited totalitarian authority of decision-making leaders in an isolated rogue sect, where then you have a limited set of individuals and you have a leadership top-down deciding who gets to marry whom.
Okay.
In a normal Western mainstream regular secular society, there is no such top-down decision-making as to who gets to marry whom. So that's why you cannot compare the examples of a very limited population set of a where the cultic control of...
Okay, so how does polygamy work for you?
Unrelated consenting adults making a choice. It is a pro-woman's choice position because today's woman is not stupid. Today's woman knows how to make her own choices. Remember that...
Well, are you suggesting the polygamous relationships are always one man and multiple women? What about multiple men and one woman?
There are a rarity of people that choose that, but the fact that few people choose that is only because of what people are making for their own individual choices. But that doesn't mean that it's not something that does happen. It's a rarity.
Right.
It's always ironic to me that individuals who somehow think that one man with two, three women is somehow this great, mighty dictator over a number of women, but then simultaneously will turn around and say, "Well, we've got to make sure that it equals the opposite and you can have one woman with multiple men." Well, if one man can supposedly dominate multiple women, how on earth do you think it's going to be for one woman being dominated by
men? I'm not suggesting or advocating for either. I'm trying to understand this. First of all, are you suggesting that... you know, our marriage laws are all two people, right? A man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman, depending on the state. But basically, they're all monogamous laws. Are you suggesting that the way polygamy should work is you have a primary wife and then other people who are part of the relationship who don't have the legal benefits of marriage? Or are you suggesting that our marriage laws should be changed and our inheritance laws and everything else, so that multiple people can participate in one marriage contract, as it were?
Well, I believe that, ultimately, government has no authority in the licensing, redefining, or controlling of the contractual arrangements of consenting adults.
But they do, because most of this has to do with tax law.
Please let me make my point. And that is in the same way that people who opposed same-sex marriage said that it's supposed to be opposite-sex couples, and those who supported same-sex marriage said, that's just an arbitrary determinant to use gender as an arbitrary determinant. Well, the truth is, the same position that said opposite-sex couples were being bigoted by having this arbitrary determinant of gender, the very same people now supporting same-sex marriage are being every bit as bigoted using the arbitrary determinant of number.
Well, I'm just asking the question because most of the benefits that come out of marriage are legal and financial. And so how do you do that with more than two people?
Well, I believe in no special rights. No special rights for those who choose one man, one woman. No special rights for those who choose same-sex marriage. And no special rights for those who choose UCAP, unrelated consenting adult polygamy. Now, with that said, that means that whatever consenting adults are being authorized to do under contractual arrangements, then freedom dictates everybody gets that freedom under the legitimacy of unrelated consenting adults making their choices. So either you abolish all big government marriage control for unrelated consenting adults, or you create an equality. On the left, I'm sure you believe in what you call marriage equality. Marriage equality means equality for every individual to make a choice. And that's all we're talking about for unrelated consenting adults, is unrelated consenting adults making a choice. And okay. So if you have the arbitrary determinant...
Mark, we're out of time. People will have to be able to read it. Hang on just a second, Mark.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I have truthbearer.org. What's the other website?
NationalPolygamyAdvocate.com.
Thank you very much. Mark Henkel, good talking with you, Mark. Well, I'm still scratching my head on this a little. I mean, in principle, I have no problem with adults doing whatever they damn well please, as long as they're not hurting other people. What I don't understand is how inheritance law would work, for example. Or let's say you've got more than one person in a marriage. Let's say you've got three people in a marriage, husband and two wife, wife and two husbands, whatever. And one of them becomes deathly sick. And there's a living will that says that the partner has the right to decide when to pull the plug. But there's two partners. And they disagree about whether to pull the plug or not. How does that work? I mean, this is, I guess I was trying, you know, I think that Mark thought I wanted to pick a fight with him and call him a some names or something. I'm really not. I think the FLDS situation in Texas and in Texas in particular, Warren Jeffs' group, where when the young boys hit the ages of, you know, puberty, basically, they got expelled from the community because they were viewed as competition by the older men who wanted to take the younger women as second wives, third wives, fourth wives, things like that. I think that is, evil. I don't have a better word for it. But I assume that our guest is not talking about that, and I think he was pretty emphatic that that's not what he's talking about. So I'm just trying to figure out how it works, and I didn't. Maybe you heard something I didn't, because I didn't hear a lot of data about how it works. All I heard was my being accused of being a name caller. When I don't think I was calling names, but maybe I missed something. So if you understand something about polygamy or polyamory, which I think I understand better, although again, you know, you've got legal situations, but people can create contracts, I suppose. Be interesting. Anyhow, we've got that. We've got this bizarre situation with the NSA diverting computers and laptops out of shipping facilities in order to install spyware. We've got the Republican Party doing everything they can to screw people who don't have jobs in the name of their getting jobs? Really? I just, you know, I don't understand that. And like I said, I mean, you know, it's the end of the year. We can pretty much talk about anything you want. It doesn't need to be one of the few topics we've talked about. There's a lot going on in the news. Anyhow, Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call.
Hey, Frank, I'm going to have to put you on hold. I'm sorry, I missed the 1 minute cue there. Let me pick your call up right after this break, okay?
Oh, thank you.
Hang on just a second, Frank. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Back 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Over the past week, having been through 13 time zones. So, 8 plus 5, I guess it is. You know, out to the West Coast and then over to the UK and then back. But it was a very, very nice holiday week. I had just a wonderful time. And I hope all is well with you, too. Frank in Cambridge, Mass., watching us on Free Speech TV. Frank, what's on your mind?
Just a sec. I have one thing to say, but the last guy was talking about polygamy.
Right.
The right wing is always talking about what's this going to do to the taxes. And that's the way they present it in Boston. Game, the look to do things.
How does polygamy screw up taxes?
Well, gay marriage and all this stuff, you know, it's just... Well, that's their argument. I have no idea what they're talking about, but that's their argument.
Because there are, you know, I can see where the right wing would say we need to limit the number of people who can get married because there are certain tax benefits. Yeah. In other words, you pay lower taxes if you're married to somebody. So if we can keep gay people from getting married, then there's more people who have to pay, you know, double pay their taxes who are actually couples. It's a pretty cruel argument, and I doubt anybody is going to make it out loud, but that might be what the Republicans say in the back rooms, but I don't.
Can I say something else?
Sure. Yeah. Go for it. You're on the air.
What I remember growing up when I used to work at a first job was in a machine shop, and the foreman, they used to call him foreman, but now they call him supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
He came up to us and said, "The world doesn't owe you a living," which meant to us that you got to, you know, put your 8 hours in,
right,
nose to the grindstone, and don't take anything unless we call you for a coffee break. And what I've noticed recently is the 1%, the bankers, the billionaires, are saying exactly that same thing. You owe us a living. You got to suffer.
Right.
You got to go through austerity.
Right.
You got to give up unemployment. You got to pay for their well-being. Now the thing about it I talked to a kid the other day. He said the economy is doing great. He said look at the stock market. And immediately the image came to my mind. That's a virtual pie.
Mm-hmm.
We have been given the crumbs of the previous pie, the real pie, and we've gotten the. What they've presented to us is this is all virtual money, virtual, you know, it's an image of well-being for the world, like in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff is presented on TV, it's presented on, you know, for a few people who are doing very well. But the point is, they are saying we owe them a living.
It seems. How anybody can be worth, you know, earning $1 million a minute or an hour or whatever, even a week, is beyond me. But then they try to, you know, game the tax law, and they try to create these offshore trusts and you know, Swiss bank accounts. And now I guess the Cook Islands is the new place where you stash your money, ill-gotten gains or just money that you don't want to be hit with inheritance tax for, things like that. But, yeah, it seems like. you know, the wealthy. It's the end of the year, and I was the other day looking back at my income throughout the year, which is not huge, but it's not insignificant. I mean, I make a good living, and it just suddenly hit me that if I was making money the way Mitt Romney was making money, I would be paying 15% or 20% income tax instead of, you know, 20 something and change, or almost 30, so whatever the percentage is. I frankly, I won't know until the middle of next year when my taxes get done, but it's like there are all these, you know, if instead of paying myself a salary, I could pay myself dividends, which I could do if I owned a publicly owned company. I mean, it's like because my company only has like a dozen employees, I can't sell stock in it and then take the stock back and then pay myself with dividends on the, you know, I mean, there's all these games that you can play if you're a millionaire that you can't play if you're just a thousandaire. Am I making sense?
You do good. Mitt Romney just tore down his place in La Jolla, California, and he's going to rebuild a bigger one. You know, the one with the garage.
Right.
He tore it down.
Yeah, I know. He basically bought it for the lot.
Yeah. He tore that place down. He built a joint, which was magnificent, a castle with a garage. And then he tore. I ran into a guy on vacation from La Jolla, California. He said, he came back. He told me last October, this guy, he was a Democrat from that area of the country, believe it or not. Yeah. He said that he, Mitt Romney, tore that palace down, and he's building a bigger one.
Right. Now, it's like he's got more money than he knows what to do with.
I just heard that they got $91 billion of Wall Street bonuses.
Wow.
83% of that $83 billion of that, $83 billion is coming from the tax. It's coming from the taxes, the tax writer from the Treasury.
It's coming basically from the loopholes that they have.
Yeah. It's,
in other words, you and I are paying for it.
That's what I mean. That's the why I say they're telling us that we owe them a living.
Yeah.
We, you know, some Joe Schmo.
Well, this is the essence of Reaganomics, Frank. We have seen the largest transfer of wealth from working people to rich people in the United States since the 1920s. It happened in the 1920s, and it's happened again over the last three decades. And it's, you know, Reaganomics and Hoovernomics are really, you know, Harding Coolidge Hoovernomics are essentially the same thing. And it's time for us to roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
No, I believe it. I just saw an article by Julie Willens and I started reading it. It said Reagan was the era of math. He wasn't a beautiful, you know, wonderful revolutionary guy.
No, I mean, there's been this project to reinvent Reagan where they name a library after him in every county in America or something, but he was a terrible president. Frank, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
One of the most criminal presidencies in the history of the United States is the Reagan presidency. We'll be right back. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Glenn Greenwald was talking with Amy Goodman over at Democracy Now! And she just asked the question so bluntly and so simply, and he answered it so straightforward and direct that I refer you to the Democracy Now!, the entire story. In fact, there's a clip of it, obviously, over at democracynow.org, and the one I'm looking at is over at commondreams.org, which is a great website. But here, just listen to this. This is Amy Goodman asking Glenn Greenwald, how does this NSA thing work? How do they get a hold of your computer? What's the deal?
I mean, just to be really specific, you order a computer and it's coming UPS or it's coming FedEx, and they have it redirected to their own, you know, to the NSA, and they put in the malware, the spyware, and then send it on to you?
Correct. That's what the Der Spiegel report indicates based on the documents that they've published. We've actually been working ourselves on certain stories that should be published soon regarding the similar interdiction efforts.
So there you go. I mean, we could go on and on with it, but, we will try to get Glenn on himself and we can have a conversation with him. But boy, it's like, it's getting bizarre. It's just getting bizarre out there. The voter ID laws, by the way. Well, let me get into that later. I've got a whole bunch of people who want to get on the air here. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Here recently, I watched a show on Link, as a matter of fact, and it was featuring the two authors of Dollarocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very informative. And, you know, the more I listened and the more I thought about it, I'm beginning to wonder what is it really going to take. I am convinced the Republicans are willing to wreck this economy and wreck this society to get their way.
Oh, it's not just They're trying to so that they want to have a 1929-style depression because they know that when the Great Depression happened, when the Republicans were in charge, it was 40 years before the Republicans took political, you know, significant political power back. And they think that if they can wreck the economy while Obama is president and the Democrats control the Senate, that they can blame it on the Democrats and it'll be 40 years before the Democrats have political power back.
Sadly wrong, because time goes too fast now. You know, it took three constitutional amendments, and child labor, the 40-hour work week, and I can't remember what the third one took care of. We're not going to have a true democracy in this country until the Citizens United Act is repealed.
Right.
And the author of that, a future Supreme Court justice, his last name's Lewis, I believe, he laid his plans out in the 70s.
Yeah, you're talking about Lewis Powell. He wrote a memo in 1971. It is my book, The Crash of 2016, and I don't mean this as a plug for the book, but this is the core of the book, basically, is it starts with the Powell memo in 1971, where Lewis Powell, 3 months later, Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court, and Lewis Powell lays out the plot to take over America by the economic royalists.
Correct.
But, you know, and
you know, I wonder how many people realize that Nixon sent his emissaries over there and sabotaged the Paris Peace Accords, which were the war was going to be over in 68. That is a fact. Reagan, he fouled up and told the opposition to keep our hostages so he could win the election, and Bush stole he stole both his elections.
The Reagan election was illegitimate because President Bonnie Sauter of Iran has told us. I mean, it's published in March of this year in the Christian Science Monitor. I think it's the most underreported story of the year that the Reagan administration had cut a deal with the Ayatollah, or the Reagan campaign had cut a deal with the Ayatollah when Jimmy Carter was president, to hold the hostages until after the election so that Reagan could win. But you're absolutely right. Richard Nixon blew up the 1968 Paris peace talks that LBJ had pre-negotiated with the Vietnamese. He had peace. He had already negotiated peace. LBJ had negotiated peace with the Vietnamese. Nixon went in, blew it up, said, we'll give you a better deal. LBJ had the wiretaps of this stuff from the CIA, and he called up Everett Dirksen, the leader of the Republicans in the United States Senate, and said, Everett, I'm reading their hand. I can see what they're doing. I don't want to get it in the election. I don't want the American people to learn that, you know, the guy who might be the next president is a traitor. But this is treason. Here's the amazing thing. This is another, you know, the greatest unreported story of the year. This was released just 4 years ago. The LBJ tapes, you know, it was like 50 years after his death or something like that. It was, well, I guess it's been longer than less than 50 years since he died, maybe 40, 30, whatever it was. They just released this 4 years ago. Here's the tape of Lyndon Johnson talking to Everett Dirksen.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know. But there was nothing he could do about it. So, yeah, we haven't had a legitimate Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower. period. And that is one of the most underreported stories. Really, if we're going to do a retrospective of the year, it should be the most underreported stories of the year. I think I just did two of them, or three of them. Anyhow, Annette in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Annette, what's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hi. You want to talk about polygamy?
Yes. I wanted to talk in support. I think it's a great idea when somebody has a calling for it and it's suited for their life, it can really benefit a lot of people.
I'm not opposed to that. What I don't understand is how it works. Are you suggesting that we should change our tax law so that three or four or more people can get married and have legal rights of inheritance? Or are you suggesting that it should operate the way it does with many of the polygamous Mormon communities, where you have one legal marriage and then you've basically got a bunch of other, typically wives, who are basically just kind of friends with benefits? They live in the house and they, you know, whatever. But, you know, how does it work in your mind or in your experience?
I would think that it should be an individual tax, and that the marriages should be a contract form, so that whether it's one man, one woman, same sex, or polygamous, they would have a contract deciding who would be married, who would get inheritance, who would get custody, and all that would be decided in a contract. And then each individual marriage could be a religious or secular or civil, whatever they personally want it to be. So you give everybody the equal rights to the way they want to have their life made.
Right. Yeah, and in that frame, I'm not opposed to it. Where I get skitsy about it is when it becomes, you know, institutionalized in a religion like in the Mormon Church, and the fallout is that teenage boys get very, very badly hurt by it. But if you don't mind my asking, and feel free to tell me it's none of my business, but do you have experience with polygamy?
No, I've done some studies, and my husband and I have talked about the idea, but no, we're not into it personally. But I do believe that it's a good thing for a lot of people, but it shouldn't be forced. And it shouldn't be underage, and everybody needs to be consenting, the wives, the husbands. Everybody needs to agree and have everything out in the open and such.
Yeah,
you shouldn't have anybody forcing.
That all sounds quite reasonable. Annette, thank you for calling. Thanks for sharing that perspective. Chris in Seattle, listening on KKZN. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Chris calling from Everett, Washington today. You know, I don't think this has ever been brought up on your program before, and I've talked about it with my friends for several years. Why aren't, you know, public transportation, they receive something like 90 cents out of every dollar. Public transportation is subsidized. Why aren't
they? Wait a second. That 90 cents out of every dollar, I don't know what public transportation system you're talking about. I know in many cities, They are either breaking even. I don't know of anywhere they make a profit, but they're either breaking even or they're damn close to it. Typically,
right,
that's the goal.
But I guess my point is that they're so heavily subsidized. Why do we even have to have bus fares? I mean, I just moved here from Denver. You know, I used to call and out there in Colorado. I just moved out here, and I was looking for work for a good, like, 3 weeks, and I didn't have an income. And, you know, if you don't have a vehicle and you're trying to look for a job, you don't have an income, it's pretty dang hard to get around town. And, like, if you don't have bus money, I mean, there are assistance programs where you can, you know, get, like, certain bus.
Well, I can tell you an anecdote that may illustrate the answer to your question, or it may not. When I lived in Portland and I was doing a local morning show as well as this national show, Portland experimented with taking the downtown part of their public transportation system and making it absolutely free. No tickets necessary. You know, you could just get on the train when you wanted, get off the train when you wanted. And what happened was a small group of homeless people basically just camped out on the trains. And it ruined the quality of the transportation for everybody else. So they went back to charging a small fare, at least this is my understanding, as a way basically of keeping the homeless people off the train. Now, you know, this raises the larger issue of what are we doing about homelessness in our society. But I think that might be part of the answer to your question, Chris. But I think that the other part of it is that, you know, we need to make sure that people have enough money for public transportation if they don't have a job and they need to get around. Chris, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
He keeps getting us back to this, to Thomas Paine's idea that everybody should be endowed at birth with a, you know, like George Bush was, you know, with a trust fund of some kind. Welcome back. Bruce in Criters, Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on the website on freespeechtv.org. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I'm wondering how our conversation about a living wage can be informed by the whole issue of how to have a sustainable living in the sense that, you know, if the planet, if our Earth doesn't continue to function and be healthy, you know, all these discussions about our society and treating individuals fairly is a moot point if we're not, you know, sustainable and healthy as an Earth.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. We need to be able to chew gum and walk at the same time. We need to be looking at our economics. We need to be looking at our society. We need to be looking at our ecology. We need to be looking at our planet. And you know, I think you raise an important point. Do you see a? I mean, why did you bring this up? Do you think that most people are just, you know, single issue, or that they're not, that there's not enough attention being paid to the ecology, or what?
I think so very much, and I have a sense that people find the climate change and our impacts on the Earth just to be the elephant in the room, and rather not face it, because then we might find that even the people that are living pretty low down on the scale might really be having a negative impact on the Earth. And then, of course, the people at the top are even, you know, many factors more destructive than that. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It, you know, it's very true. And you make a very good point. Yeah. Thank you very much for the call, Bruce. Good to hear from you. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, Tom. Well, I'd like to respond to Ron Paul's borrowing 70% or 72 cents for unemployment, whatever he said, give to the unemployed. How about we do a better idea? How about we put tax disincentives to companies for outsourcing jobs? Then we don't have to go to China to get the money back.
We used to do that. They were called tariffs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember that, you know. And that was how the founding fathers built the infrastructure for this country.
That's right. It was the George Washington administration that put tariffs into place in the first place. You're right.
Yeah. Well, what happened to those founding fathers?
Well, they died, and eventually Reagan came along.
Well, no, we got everything else from the Founding Fathers, the Second Amendment. How come we can't tote the accolades of the tariffs?
Well, the tariffs weren't written into the Constitution, and tariffs didn't have anything to do with, well, maybe they did, actually, with maintaining slavery. But the principal reason that the Second Amendment was written the way it was in the Constitution was to prevent the federal government from disarming state militias that ran as slave patrols. And that's the great unknown story. If you Google Slave Patrol and my name, you'll find some pretty good research and scholarship that I and others have done on this topic. Corky, thanks a lot for the call. But yeah, I think that, you know, if, you know, you look at what the NRA has done with the Second Amendment with quote gun rights. And if we could be doing the same thing about the environment or the economy, boy. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Vonda in Schertz, Texas. Hey, Vonda, what's up? You want to talk about polygamy and the
Hi.
Republican Party, really?
I've been waiting a long time to talk to you, but I hope I still remember everything I wanted to say.
Okay.
I started dialing when you were talking to the gentleman about polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I don't want to down anybody's religion. I think that polygamy, when practiced by consenting adults, is as okay as any other religion. However, the mess that went on here in Texas is not a religion. It is an organized crime unit practiced by men who want to rape children. only one of them went to prison. I consider this an insult to the Texas justice system, and I want them to fix it.
Yeah, you're talking about Warren Jeffs and his FLDC.
FLDS, yes.
Yeah, FLDS. Yeah, FLDS.
Okay.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Polygamy.
Yeah.
However they can find out to way to practice it, that's fine. I don't care. But the kind of thing that's practiced out there in El Dorado, that is not a religion. That is organized crime, and children are raped.
Yeah. Well, it's organized crime operating under the guise of religion. And, yes, many of these kids are underage, and they're being put into these relationships without their consent, and that qualifies as rape. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you, Vonda. The text I have here is that you wanted to talk about polygamy and the Republican Party. What does the Republican Party have to do with this? Or is just did Danielle just get that in there wrong?
Okay, I also think of the Republican Party the last 20 years as organized crime.
Oh, I see.
And the way they want to create sainthood for Ronald Reagan is it goes beyond the ridiculous. The man slept throughout his whole term in office. I don't know who was running the country.
Bush.
But they managed to screw it up unbelievably.
Yeah, Bush and Weinberger were principally running the country.
Well,
and Jim Baker.
True as it comes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do know that we didn't have a homeless situation, at least here where I lived. We didn't until he was in office.
Yep.
And then along comes Daddy Bush and makes it even worse.
Yep.
They dumped out the state hospital.
Yep.
We had homeless created while Reagan was in office.
Yep.
Now every corner, every intersection that you come to, you've got homeless people sitting with signs. We'll do anything for food.
Yeah.
I have hungry children. I'm tired of this.
Yeah.
Will somebody please wake up the Republican Party if any of them care? I don't know if anybody cares anymore.
Well, I think this is the part of the problem is the Republican Party. You've got some people in the Republican Party who are just good old-fashioned sociopaths, and they tend to lean toward the libertarian view, you know, the heartless view. And then you've got elected Republicans who are basically doing what the billionaires tell them to do, and then you've got a bunch of billionaires who are themselves are sociopaths. And it's, you know, you mix up mental illness with these dictates of the Supreme Court, and it's an absolute mess. Vonda, I'm totally with you. Thank you for the call and for sharing that. Bill in Cannon City, Colorado. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk with you about it tied me into the polygamy issue based on that you dealt with answers that you made on money and inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we really, you know, the focus should be more on independence and progressive ways of thinking to say that we might be able to move towards a movement towards getting away from tying into inheritances and government and money and dealing with a backwards, if you will, go back to the movements of during the agricultural age where you had 14 kids and so forth and so on. And they lived outside the box. They lived outside the government, and they farmed and made a profit in small ways.
But my point, Bill, and forgive me if I seem obsessed with money. I don't think I am. But my point was that most of the laws that have to do with marriage, and there's some 17,000 laws in the United States that have the word marriage associated with them. Most of them have to do with taxes or the right to inherit, or the right to have control over another person's property or estate in the event of their insufficiency and incompetence. And so the question that I was asking the polygamist was, how do you deal with that? How, you know, if all of the laws of all the states define marriage as a marriage between two people, then how do you deal with these legal issues, most of which have to do with money and property? Some of them presumably have to do with other things like, you know, visiting people in the hospital and whatnot. How do you deal with that? And I never got a decent answer from him, in my opinion.
Right, I agree. But at the same time, you steered the conversation towards dealing with the monetary issue.
I acknowledge that, you know, polyamory, I mean, if multiple people want to be in love with each other, I don't have a problem with that as long as they're consenting adults.
I don't have a problem with that either, because it's a part of being progressive in our nation to be able to be free and democratic. But what my point really is that if you're going to take on that lifestyle, most of the people that take on that lifestyle are going to be doing that outside the box. So they're going to be doing that outside the worry of dealing with the inheritance issue and the hospital visits.
But that'll become a worry when they hit 70 years old.
Right. But the thing is, though, is that they're going to have, well, we hope anyway, is that they're going to have an infrastructure of their own. And if we can do that around different topics that you talk about, and let me tell you, I love your progressive outlook, and I love all the topics that you do deal with that are outside the main media. I appreciate you very much. But at the same time, I do find you always tying things into how we can deal with things financially instead of dealing with things in a way to where we can become more progressive in a way of sustainable living for the individual and small communal outfits. That, the Venus Project is an example. But that's why I wanted to call you and felt compelled to do so. And
okay, well, thanks for sharing your perspective, Bill. What would you? We just have a few seconds left. What would you suggest? Well, actually, we're out of time. We'll have this conversation another time. But you know, thank you for your perspective. I appreciate it, and let me seriously think about it. And thank you very much for watching or listening or however you were. It's off the board now. I missed it. We'll be back. I want to talk in our third hour. Well, yeah.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, for the past 32 years, Americans have been living a lie. It's a lie that helps out rich people and it screws working people, and it's a lie that needs to be called out. The people promoting this lie, most of them rich people themselves, have been so good at promoting this lie that pretty much everyone believes it. It's even asserted as fact without contradiction in the mainstream media. You can find that on Wikipedia, but it's a lie. The lie is that raising income taxes on rich people and hugely profitable companies hurts economies and even leads to unemployment. The truth is that raising income taxes on rich people and hugely profitable companies actually helps economies and causes companies to hire more and more people, thus lowering unemployment. What makes this lie particularly relevant right now is that the French Constitutional Court, their court that decides what's constitutional and what's not, has just agreed with the new socialist government that it is totally constitutional, legal, to raise the very top income tax rates on very wealthy individuals and hugely profitable corporations to 50%, effectively 75% when you add in there are other taxes like their equivalent of our FICA that funds health care and retirement and things. This lie that tax increases like the one the French Constitutional Court just approved raise unemployment, and the tax cuts reduce unemployment, is widely believed because, like so many big lies, it has a small germ of truth at its center. The germ of truth is that when people who spend nearly all or all of their income every year, basically poor people and working class people, have a little bit more money in their pockets, they spend it. That spending increases economic activity. There's more demand for goods and services. And to meet that demand, employers hire more workers. So you'd think that if you cut the taxes on poor and low-wage people, they'd have more money, which they'd spend, and it would stimulate the economy. And that's true except for one thing, which is the germ of the lie that rich people use to get everybody to think that tax cuts for rich people help economies. And here's the lie. While it would be true that if you cut income taxes for the poor and lower-end working people so that they had more money in their pockets, it would stimulate the economy, it's impossible. Why is it impossible? Because as Rush Limbaugh and Mitt Romney point out as often as possible, the bottom 47% of American workers make so little money that they don't pay any income taxes. So there's no tax to cut. So when Republicans talk about tax cuts, they're not talking about tax cuts for working people. So what about cutting taxes on rich people? Wouldn't that give them more money to spend or even invest, which would stimulate economic growth? I mean, that's the core of the tax religion of Limbaugh, who has a reported $400 million contract, and Romney, who is reported to have paid no taxes for years on hundreds of millions of dollars in income. Cut rich people's taxes, they say, and the good times will roll. Right? The thing that makes this a lie is that rich people behave differently from poor and working class people. When they get extra money from tax cuts, they don't spend it. After all, they pretty much have everything they want or need. Instead, as we learned about Mitt Romney in 2012, they opened bank accounts in the Cayman Islands in Switzerland and stashed that money for future generations. Or they'll buy an American company like Sensata and move it to China where they can get cheaper labor and pollute all they want. Or since they got the money relatively easily and don't worry so much about losing it, after all their basic needs are already covered, they gamble with it. They call it investing in real estate and the market. But it's really just gambling. And none of this, of course, translates into American jobs. And history backs this up. In 1922, when Republican Warren Harding dropped the top tax rate from 73% down to 25%, it kicked off a gambling real estate and stock market bubble that burst in 1929. President Roosevelt fixed that by raising the top rate on the uber-rich back up over 90%, which led to over 40 years of stability and prosperity. Rich people left their money in their companies, and they typically only took 30 times what their employees did as pay. The economy boomed, and the middle class prospered. Then Reagan came along, and he dropped the top tax rate down to 28%, leading within a year to the worst recession since the Great Depression, followed by the savings and loan crisis. Bill Clinton took the top income tax rate back up to 39%, and presto, the economy boomed. But then Bush Jr. came into office, cut it back down, and we got another crash and lots of unemployment. It's a simple point of fact. Four times since 1913, we've had big tax cuts on the rich. Two led to major crashes, while the other two led to stagnation for working people. All, however, made the rich a lot richer. But what happens when taxes go up? As author Larry Beinhart points out, quote, since 1950, we have had five tax increases on the rich. Four out of five times unemployment went down. In other words, it got better. Things got better for working people. The flip side, as Beinhart points out, is that since 1950, we've had 10 cuts to the top marginal tax rate. Six out of 10 times unemployment has gone up. In other words, it's gotten worse. Tax cuts for the rich, in other words, screw working people at least 60% of the time and never help working people. When Ronald Reagan came into office, taxes on rich people were over 70%, and the American middle class was the strongest it had ever been in history. Ever since the Reagan tax cuts, however, we've been lurching from bubble to bubble, economic crisis to economic crisis. Now, the French have figured it out. If you want a stable economy, you want a strong middle class? You need to tax the rich. That's why their version of the Supreme Court just okayed a big new tax on the wealthiest people in France. Countries of Scandinavia have been taxing their billionaires and millionaires for over half a century, and doing so has worked great for places like Sweden and Denmark. And the history of much of the 20th century shows that taxing the rich works right here in America, too. So it comes down to one really simple thing. If you want an economy that works, that doesn't depend on rich people gambling with money in the stock market, because that's, you know, when you see, oh, the stock market went up. I was in London on must have been Friday. I arrived there Friday morning. I flew over Thursday night. And I was watching, and I got there like at 8 o'clock in the morning or something. I checked into my hotel. And I'm watching it must have been CNBC. It was one of the, and they were, it was like the end bell, right? This is going to be the end of the year, the end of the last full week of the year, or whatever. And we'll see where the Dow is going to end. Is it going to end up or down? Well, it's up 1.38%, you know, or points rather. It ended down like 0.3% or something. But, you know, there was all this excitement and, you know, these two women and these two guys, and they're like, oh my God. And, you know, it's hit all time highs this year. It's over 13,000. You know, that's gambling. That's rich people. That's not the economy. That's the stock market. I mean, literally, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. It's not the stock market that counts. If you really want an economy that works, we need to do one simple thing. Actually, there's a number of things we should do, obviously, you know, but that I've talked about on many occasions. But the first thing we need to do is ignore the Republican lies and roll back the Reagan tax cuts. It's not the Bush tax cuts you have to worry about. It's the Reagan tax cuts. Reagan took us from 74% down to 28%. We need to go back to 74%. Yep. Now, the average person making under $1 million a year would never even see that. It would be meaningless to them. But it would stabilize our economy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we need politicians who have the courage, as Bernie Sanders has said in this program, to say it's time to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Now, welcome back. Bill in Fresno, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Well, to share one thing, a couple things, Tom. First of all, I've been reading everything I think that you've written that I can get my hands on, and I'm probably one of those hunter people. I don't know. But anyway, I had a couple comments to make on the poor and the fact that I believe it's the scriptures that say that the poor would always be with us.
Well, that's badly taken out of context. If you're interested, I'll give you the context. But if not, you can just continue with your conversation.
Okay. I was in the context or whatever. I just see today as a time when the poor are not with us.
Right.
So, like, they're somewhere else, and they should be with us, and we should embrace our neighbors and love them, and we're not doing that.
We ignore them.
Go ahead.
We ignore them. We isolate them. We imprison them. You're right.
Right. And they're not our neighbors, and we're not. We kind of just take advantage of them.
Yeah.
I have this thing about him. If we embrace the poor, I think a lot of our problems will be solved.
I agree. Well,
and I appreciate everything you've done, Tom.
Thank you.
I read The Prophet's Way. And almost everything I can get my hands on that you've written.
Well, thank you.
Bless you. And thank you.
Thank you, Bill, and bless you. And let me just give you the context of that quote, if I may, just because it's... I believe it was... I want to say Salome. It was one of the women who hung out with Jesus, wanted to wash his feet with perfume. And yeah. one of his disciples, and I think it was Judas, said, you know, what are you doing? We could sell that perfume and give the money to the poor. And, you know, because Jesus was all about, you know, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. And Jesus said, you know, the poor you will always have with you. Me, you will only have with you for a short time. Don't stop her from doing this. And basically what he was saying was, you know, this is a special circumstance. We are all here together. We're doing really important work. We're entitled to have a party once in a while. You know, let the lady put some perfume on my feet if it means something to her, if it's important to her. We don't all have to sit around, you know, like sourpusses. He was not saying the poor are always going to be with you. You know, live with it. That was not the point. But that's the way the Republicans take it. Am I making sense?
Yeah, you're making sense. My point would be that I think when in the same context there, in another place that Jesus spoke of the same thing, I believe, he said something to the effect that the poor you have with you always, but you will not always have me. And then elsewhere, I believe in the scriptures, he said, when you do it to the least of these,
yes,
then it, and,
that's in Matthew 25.
Yeah, okay, yeah,
yeah.
Matthew 25. So I was thinking that, you know,
if we see Jesus in the face of the poor, okay?
Yes.
If they're with us, it's going to change a lot of things, I think.
Well, and that's the great challenge. I genuinely think that when Pope Benedict, I don't know if you saw that picture of him embracing and kissing that badly deformed man. Man might have been a leper. But I really think that when Pope Benedict sees a poor person, a child, a deformed person, he sees Jesus looking back at him. And that's the great challenge for all of us as human beings, is whether we're Christians or whatever, that when we look into the eyes of another, particularly another less fortunate than us, that we see God looking back at us. We see divinity looking back at us. Bill, thank you for the call. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking the truth, some multinational corporations would really rather you to know all about. Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin, listening to WCPT. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind today?
Well, a couple quick things. Earlier you talked about why we don't seem to have young people and adults who are astute on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, number one, it has to do with teaching, and it has to do with the fact that we no longer teach consumer math.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do a lot of the social studies classes because they're not on the test.
Yeah, you're right. It used to be called home ec and social studies, and we don't really do either one anymore.
And I think that has to do with the George Bush era, and I like to believe it was another No Child Left Behind Republican plan.
I agree.
Dumb them down.
I agree.
Secondly, the computer issue. I've worried for a long time that because we've outsourced all our technology to other countries, there could be worms, there could be viruses, there could be anything that could destroy our entire civilization in this country if they were planted in that stuff, because it's not checked when it comes here. How do you know what's in your computer or your phone?
Yeah, or your voting machine. We can't build a cruise missile without chips from China. And we've got both members of our military and members of China's military saying that, you know, if there's going to be a World War III, or if there's going to be a major conflict in the future, in all probability, it's going to be between the United States and China, and we can't build a cruise missile without a chip from China. What's wrong with that picture? And I'm no, you know, Paul Wolfowitz warmonger, but I really do think that every country should be independent and should have their own domestic industry, which manufactures particularly the things that would be referred to as critical infrastructure.
And one last quick thing. I think a lot of what has happened has to do with, unfortunately, Gerald Ford. Had we prosecuted Nixon,
yes,
and ferreted out all the people that, including Dick Cheney and all those people,
yep,
we would not be in the situation we're in now, because by doing that pardon, they all got off and they remained in government, and that's why we're at where we're at.
I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And it was Jerry Ford didn't just pardon Nixon; he pardoned a whole bunch of them. You know, Cap Weinberger, and you know, who engineered the whole coup with Vietnam. You know, with blowing up the peace talks in 1968. And the whole bunch of them, and then they got pardoned again, by the way, at the end of the Reagan administration, or ignored again or whatever. I mean, you know, Reagan actually let a number of people go to prison, but I think that you're absolutely right. Pat, thank you for the call, and thanks for making an excellent point. Brandon in Fairfield, Ohio, listening on Sirius. Hey, Brandon, what's up?
I actually wanted to talk about, you know, when it comes to the economy, how much power corporations and multinational corporations have over everything. Shouldn't we possibly create an amendment to the Constitution that creates a separation of business and state, you know, both ways, you know, making it so that corporations cannot lobby the government and essentially bribe them,
mm-hmm,
to do what they want to do for their interest.
Yeah.
And so that government cannot impose federal, nationwide regulations on businesses as well, or tax a business for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a good solution for both sides of the equation, because if you look at, I'm not liberal or conservative, I'm not either of the above.
You sound more libertarian, actually, Brandon.
Yeah. I'm not going to label myself that because, okay, you know,
yeah,
it gets icky.
Okay. Well, let me just take the two pieces. Let's separate these for a moment. Okay. Your suggestion was twofold. First, that we should not allow corporations basically to lobby the government. The simple way to do that, the way that corporations assert that power, is with money. And the Supreme Court has allowed that by saying that money is not property. It's not something of value. It is instead speech. And the First Amendment protects speech. And so if we were to amend the Constitution to simply say money is not speech, money is property, then that would allow Congress to pass laws, and they would do it in a heartbeat, by the way, that would neuter the power of these big corporations. So and there's an effort to do that. MoveToAmend.org has been working on that for some time, and they're doing a great job of it. And there are other organizations as well, but Move to Amend is the cleanest, the purest, the best, in my opinion. And I have no personal affiliation with them other than just having watched them over the years, and I'm in awe of the work that they're doing. So now the flip side of that, though, is you said corporations similarly should not suffer under national regulations or taxes. If over 60% of all of our court systems are used by corporations to enforce contracts, if a large portion of our federal legislation, and probably over 80, maybe over 90% of our federal legislation, has nothing to do with individuals or criminal law, it has to do with business law and civil law. If the infrastructure of, and if much of our infrastructure, from our roads to our air traffic control system, is used to transport product rather than people, then business is using the commons. They're using the infrastructure of government very heavily. Why should they not pay for that?
Well, this is what I say. Okay, there are people that run that business, and this gets into taxation, because everybody pays for those roadways. Everybody pays for, it all goes into a tax pool. So instead of taxing, because it's say like if I want to run a business, why should my business be considered an individual or an entity that has to pay a tax?
Because it's using, because your business is going before the judge and saying that they want to sue Brandon for the $50 he owes them, and the judge is using his time to do that.
Right, but that's Brandon. That's me, not the business itself.
No, I'm saying, you know, a business. AT&T wants to sue you, and, you know, so they're a corporate entity. They should they not have to pay that? I mean, you know.
An individual, say like when it comes to taxes, I think everybody throughout the business.
No, I know you're making the double taxation argument. That is the argument for there being no corporate income tax and no dividend tax. And I'm saying it's a non-argument, Brandon, because corporations, just like individuals, use the resources of government. They should pay for them, whether it's on a fee basis or on a tax basis. Brandon, we're out of time. I'm sorry. We'll have to carry this on another time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because it is a really good and important conversation, and Brandon, I appreciate your calling and making it. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind? You wanted to talk about the crash of 2016?
Yes, I just got done reading your book last week, and there's a couple spots in the book that I find very, well, contradictory. On 124, you said that the GOP, when they were meeting at the restaurant, that they were talking about repealing tax cuts for the top 1% and spending huge amounts of money to rebuild America, similar to FDR's WPA. Now, I find it very hard to believe that the GOP would ever consider rebuilding America and Joe Sixpack at all.
Can one of you guys hand me that my book there? Let me just take a look at what you're talking about
page
here.
Page 124.
Yeah, I don't remember specifically writing that. Hang on just a second here. Okay, page 124. I probably shouldn't do that. Okay. After all, Democrats are now in control of the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives for the first time since before the Reagan Revolution, and they were talking about, this is the Democrats, we're talking about things like repealing tax cuts for the top 1%, reforming health care, passing a carbon tax, and spending huge amounts of money to rebuild America reminiscent of Franklin Roosevelt's WPA.
Exactly.
Democrats, we're talking like that. Hello?
Hello, Tom.
Yeah, the Democrats were talking about those things.
Oh, was this the Democratic meeting?
Yes, yeah. The sentence says, after all, Democrats were now in control of the White House for the first time since the Reagan Revolution, and they, the Democrats, were talking about things like repealing tax cuts for the top 1%, passing a carbon tax, and spending huge amounts of money. So, yeah, I was referring to the Democrats, not the Republicans. I'm sorry, the sentence could have been written a little more clearly.
Oh, okay, because when they said a restaurant, I just assumed it was a restaurant.
No, the Republicans were definitely not talking about those things.
Okay. Because I found that hard to believe.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And what the other problem you had with the book?
Oh, on page 162.
Okay.
You said that the European Central Bank forced George Papandreou to cancel the referendum, and they literally kicked him out of office.
Yeah, they did.
Greece was the founding nation of democracy. Greece is going to stand up for such moves?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, what had happened was, and in fact, Papandreou was replaced. I set the book aside. I'm not going to go through and read the whole page, but I can probably do most of this from memory. Papandreou was replaced by a guy named Papandamos, if I recall, or something like that. It's on that page. Probably you can tell me, who used to be a member of the central bank. He was a bankster. And basically the bank came to Greece and said, you guys elected this guy's prime minister, but you can't have him anymore because he's talking too much like a populist, and he's talking about withdrawing Greece from the European Union. Because the simple fact of the matter is, if Greece had still had the drachma, they wouldn't have been in the crisis they were in. Because they had bought into the euro, they had to go along with basically Germany. And if they had had the drachma, they could have simply devalued their own currencies, as they had done in the past many times, and they had revalued it at other times. And they could have gotten through it just fine. But Greece, Spain, Italy, Ireland, Portugal, they're all suffering from the fact that, unlike the Brits, who did not make this stupid mistake, the Brits still have the pound. They gave away their national currency, and in doing so, they gave away their financial sovereignty. And in giving away their financial sovereignty, they essentially turned their country over to the EU, the EU Parliament, basically. Yeah.
One more question.
If you don't believe me on that, it is a pretty amazing thing to say. Spend some time. DuckDuckGo is in my opinion, is the best search engine out there. Google does a fine job, but Google tends to pull up the right wing stuff because everybody's optimized for it. DuckDuckGo.com is a really good search engine. Just look it up, and you'll see that what I was saying is true. There's also footnotes for pretty much everything in the book.
Then the central bank did nothing but pull a coup.
That's right. The European Central Bank, later in the book, you'll recall there's a chapter about how basically Germany won World War II, and Germany exercises the majority of the control over the European Central Bank. Yeah.
Okay, Tom. Thank you.
Sure. You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Randy. John, in Cayucos, California?
Yeah. Cayucos, yeah. I met you in Santa Monica back in November 20th, heard you speak.
And, well, thanks for dropping by, John.
As usual.
What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I got a picture with you. I bought a book from you. You autographed it. I got another one off the Free Speech CD for a donation. And
oh, great.
I'll be up here. But just on a lighter note, I was thinking, when Reagan, because I grew up down in L.A. and everyone's into Reagan in California and everything. And I remember the change. I was born in 61, and I remember the change of the homeless population in the 80s and how it began to grow here and how so many people flocked to the good weather because they became homeless. And it wasn't because they were poor. It was because they had mental issues.
That's right. That's right. Reagan did was he cut funding for mental illness and in the name of, and a lot of liberals went along with this, in the name of deinstitutionalizing people, the progressive perspective was let's move them into small group home kind of situations. But Reagan cut the funding for that. So he closed the institutions, but he never did open the small the small group homes. And so the mentally ill, particularly the schizophrenic, the paranoid schizophrenics, the people who
were loose on the streets. You
know, yeah, they ended up living on the streets, and they still are to this day.
Yeah, and the reason I say on a lighter note is because some of those people, who's to say they're not the CEOs of some of our largest companies?
They will be.
You know, maybe that's my concern.
You know, it's really their bego for the luck of the draw. I mean, the lucky sperm club. I mean, the you know, some of those folks, if they'd been born into very wealthy families, would have had very, very different outcomes. And, yeah, excellent point. John, thank you for calling and making that point. It's a brilliant one. Rich in Jefferson City, Missouri. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Well,
you didn't like Jimmy Carter?
I want to qualify. I'm not supporting anything that Reagan did. What I hear a lot of on your show is Reagan bashing, and it's justified. Don't get me wrong. But if you mentioned the Powell memorandum, and there was also that was kind of the Republican dogma. It was also during the Carter administration. There was. The Trilateral Commission did one document that they published. It was called The Crisis of Democracy, which is kind of the Democratic version of the Powell Memorandum. It's basically just saying there's too much democracy.
Was this in 78 by any chance?
I think it may have been 78. A lot of those people from the Trilateral Commission were on the Carter administration,
right.
Made up some of his...
Yeah, Brzezinski in particular. Yeah. But, you know, my one criticism, well, actually, I have a number of them, but my main criticism of the Carter administration is that halfway through his administration, I mean, you know, Jimmy Carter, I think he's one of the few presidents that we've ever had who doesn't have a bone of sociopathy in his body. I mean, he's a genuine person. And he's the only president, really, that we've had who didn't have a little war during his presidency for political purposes. But what happened was in 1978, halfway through his presidency, Maggie Thatcher was elected in the UK overwhelmingly. And she began, you know, busting the coal miners union selling off a lot of the state-run industries. And initially it looked like it was working well. It looked like it was generating money for the government and things were getting more efficient. And Jimmy Carter looked at that and said, you know, maybe it's not such a bad idea. And he privatized or he deregulated the trucking industry in the United States. And I had firsthand knowledge of this. I had a friend who was a truck driver back in the day, you know, when he had the protections in the union and the, you know, the rules and regulations were there, but you could make it a career for the rest of your life. And it was a good career. And now you're hanging on by your fingernails. He did that with the trucking industry. He did it with the travel industry. And I know that from personal experience because in 1983, as a result of Carter's 1979 deregulation of the travel industry, Louise and I were able to start a travel agency in Atlanta that went from zero to $6 million in revenue in 3 years, made the front page of the Wall Street Journal. You know, we were basically exploiting the opportunities that Carter created, which initially looked good. You know, the travel industry was growing and it looked like it was a good thing. But now the travel agencies are all dead. They're all gone. It's all, you know, the airlines have taken over. It's a small handful of very large corporations. The company that Louise and I started, we sold it in 1986 and retired to Germany and, you know, with our family and worked with a nonprofit there. And that company continued to exist. It was called Sprigory Travel. International Wholesale Travel was the corporate name. And just last year, it was sold to a multi-billion-dollar corporation. It had generated over $250 million in revenue over the years, none of which I saw. But the point is that Carter had bought into this whole Thatcherism thing to, I think, much too great a degree. And, you know, history, I don't think, has judged him well for that.
Well, I, the only thing I would say is that...
Even though I made a lot of money on it.
I understand, but the one thing I would say is if you've never read The Crisis of Democracy and that neoliberalism 101...
Yeah, well, and that's what Carter was buying into. I'm going to have to look that up. I'll make a note of it during the break. The Crisis of Democracy by the Trilateral Commission?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Rich, for that. I appreciate it. I'm telling you, we've got the smartest listeners on earth on this program. Crisis of Democracy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It turns out The Crisis of Democracy was written in 1975, but, I have to look it up. That's my project for this week. Welcome back. Shane tells me there's used copies out there for $299, but I said, I want the Cliff Notes version. I'm sure I'll be able to find it someplace. Anyway, Robert in Great Court, South Carolina. Robert, thank you for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, I just learned that in our community, a 15-year-old boy shot and killed a 12-year-old girl.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I think it's sad that we spend too much time worried about who's president and what our children are doing.
Yeah, yeah. And what they have access to. I mean, you know, that kid never should have had access to that gun, or if he did, that gun should have had a trigger lock on it.
Yeah, some people's Second Amendment rights need to be curtailed in a big way.
I don't disagree. I think that while the Second Amendment protects the right of the states to have a militia, it does not protect the right of an individual to own a gun independent of registration, licensure, and insurance. And if we require that of automobiles, because automobiles can be used to kill people, it just makes the smallest amount of sense that we require that of gun owners. Excellent point. Robert, thank you for calling and making it. Barbara in Helena, Montana, watching us on Free Speech TV. What's up, Barbara?
Well, my conversation with you, Tom, I listen to you every day. And I had two sons serve tours in Iraq. And one of them served three tours. So there's no accountability from the Pentagon and the Defense Department for the billions of dollars that have completely disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But the soldiers have to be accountable. Mm-hmm. My son was there three times. Two of those tours, he had young soldiers under him. He brought every one of them home because he had a dedication and a responsibility to those wives and mothers at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have soldiers committing suicide because they're discovering that we lied to them.
Yeah.
And we did it for oil and for all kinds of other reasons of anything we want. We're just going to go get it.
Yeah.
And we're not going to ask permission or get a vote or a consensus. And it started with Reagan down there in El Salvador, Nicaragua.
And
we
Grenada.
Called them communists back then because they were hungry.
Mm-hmm.
They're still hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And they're angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're getting a lot of anger around the world. And we have to deal with the Defense Department. It is a big, big.
No, it's half our budget. It's half our budget. If our Defense Department was instead an international Department of Education and Food, and we were feeding and educating the world rather than terrorizing them, life would be so different.
Right. So we have to quit letting them make us attack each other.
Mm-hmm.
I have to stop attacking.
I agree. Barbara, very, very well said. Thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. The genuine and heartfelt quality of it comes through very, very clearly on the call. Thank you very much, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And Kurt in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or California, excuse me. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. How are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Kurt, how about you?
I'm doing well. And before I get to my point, I just wanted to say that I owe you a vote of thanks for introducing me to progressive radio or talk, because I happened to stumble into a Mensa meeting back in 2008,
mm-hmm.
and it was around Christmas time, and you were actually talking to the group, and supporting Barack Obama.
Yeah, I was the keynote speaker.
Yeah, it was somewhere in Southern California, and I was a DJ. I was setting up as you were wrapping up, so I don't know if you heard me getting my stuff together with the host, but I heard you speaking, and I thought to myself, that was one of the first times that I heard a Caucasian person speaking about supporting Barack Obama, and I thought to myself, wow, that's great. That's a real cool guy.
Okay.
You know, so after that, that was around, it was around the time that the time gets a little confusing because it was around the time that America, the radio, something, what was that group?
Air America? Yeah.
It was going off the air or dissolving.
Yeah.
And so when I asked the guy who hired you to speak, he said they didn't know where to find you because you were off the air by then.
Yeah.
You know, so.
No, I actually wasn't. Air America went away, but I never went away. We started this show almost a year before Air America was created. In fact, an article I wrote for Common Dreams became the original business plan of Air America. Eventually, Air America hired me, or they didn't hire me, they licensed my show. And then about 6 months before they went away, Louise and I left Air America and said, you know, good luck, guys, but we don't think that you're running this business well. But our show has never gone away. It comes and goes on stations, you know, from time to time, but it's continuing to grow. But thank you for your kind words, Kurt.
Right. So let me get to my point, please. Mm-hmm. Please, before you let me go. Regarding the philosophy behind the Republican psyche,
mm-hmm.
and what you were saying earlier about how they claim that if they raise taxes, were to raise taxes on the rich and corporations, that it would somehow create the loss of jobs in America.
Right.
And you're absolutely correct in stating that, you know, that's factually false.
Yes.
You know, because Keynesian economics, you know, says differently. Mm-hmm. But what you have to understand is that in their mind, in their Ayn Rand point of view, the reason why raising taxes will create job loss is because they have this unholy alliance that says that if their taxes are raised, they're going to start firing people. Like this Siegel guy, who this real estate guy in Florida who owns a couple of timeshare, the largest timeshare in America company,
mm-hmm.
and he said if President Obama got reelected, he was going to start laying people off and firing people just because, you know, he got reelected. So
mm-hmm.
you have this thing where they don't base their statements in fact. They base it in this unholy alliance with being greedy.
Yeah.
And if their taxes goes up, then they're just going to fire people, not because they have to. It's because they want to in order to force some kind of retribution because,
yeah.
you know, how dare they, you know, raise my
But the net is that that's a bad business practice. You know, I mean, that doesn't help them in business in any way, that kind of irrationality. And when you look at these guys who have said this, you know, in 2008, there were all these guys who said, if Obama comes in, I'm going to lay people. None of them laid anybody off. You know, if Obamacare goes through, I'm going to, you know, make half my employee, you know, the Olive Garden, the Donald. They never did it. It's all talk. It's all bluster.
Right. Right. It's all bluster. They never followed through because, you know, of course, you know, it's they talked themselves into a corner.
Yeah.
But
yeah, they may be dumb, but they're not stupid.
Right. But I'm saying that none of these TV show hosts, whenever they, you know, John Boehner, you know, when he was on his rant in 2008, I mean, we're going to focus like a laser on jobs, jobs, jobs. And if they raise taxes, it'll cost jobs. So,
right.
you know, so that's not an option.
Yeah.
But no one ever pinned John Boehner down and said, well, how exactly will raising taxes lose jobs?
You know, yeah. And why is it that every time taxes have been raised in America, unemployment has gone down and employment has gone up? It has been a good thing every time taxes on the rich have been raised. And we have
exactly.
to distinguish between taxes on the rich and taxes on the poor, because when taxes on working people were raised, it actually hurt us. You know, when Ronald Reagan doubled the FICA tax, it hurt America. In fact, it threw us into a recession. But that was on working people, people who at the time made less than $38,000 a year. But when Reagan cut taxes on the rich, it threw us into an even worse depression. I mean, it was the biggest stock market crash since 29.
Right, right. And so now fast forward to today, I think tomorrow or today is the expiration of extended unemployment benefits. How is that? How is that little $25 billion worth of savings supposed to get our economy back on track in the eyes of the Republicans? It doesn't.
No, it's punishment for being poor. I mean, it represents a few hours of expenditures, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan or by the Pentagon. But it's not about the money. It's about punishing people for not being rich, for being poor.
Right. And pretty much punishing people for voting President Obama in the office.
That's right.
In 2012.
That's right.
Because
they're trying to crash the economy so that he'll take the blame for it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Speaking of crashing the economy, Tom, I don't know if you heard, but there's a radio station out here in Los Angeles that has completely changed its format from progressive to all conservative.
Yeah, I know. KTLK did that. You know, the good news for us is that we're on KPFK. We're very pleased to be on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. But yeah, that, you know, that happens, and that has happened on some stations and others. You know, we've actually picked up an affiliate this week. Gillette Public Access in Gillette, Wyoming just picked up our show starting today. So, Kurt, thanks a lot for the call, and thank you for your kind words and for having shown up at that Mensa meeting. That was a hoot. The one organization that I tried to join, and I flunked their test, as a 13-year-old, invited me back in 2008 to keynote the speech. It was wonderful. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, more debate, stimulating talk, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.